session number 27073, Reel 10.
Billy Drake, Reel 10. So, could you tell me the events of the German surrender at Eisenhower's headquarters, what you were doing and what you saw?
Yeah, well, have I explained that my job there was to brief the top brass on the situation as far as the Allied Air Forces were concerned, and got to know most of them quite well.
Actually, how did you receive that information that you were briefing?
From the various air forces. We got a full report every night from Fighter Command, from Bomber Command, from the 15th Air Force there, from the 8th, from the 9th. And we correlated that all into a picture, and with the main factors of what they've been up to, and that made a story, and that was the story that I gave the top brass at first thing in the morning.
I would imagine at that time that the picture was good.
Oh, yeah. The war was practically over.
And did you take any... You know, did you do any reconnaissance work at all personally at that period?
No, I did one or two personal trips, and every time I went anywhere, I borrowed Sir James Robb's black Spitfire, which had four stars on it, and one or two landings were quite memorable in that the top brass of these airfields used to come rushing out because they'd seen four stars, and out walked a wing commander saying anyway, so the other jobs I did, one was to pick up an apologia from Ribbentrop to Churchill, written on all pieces of dirty old paper, lavatory paper, da da da, because he obviously hadn't got a filing system with it, and I flew that up to back to England and handed over personally to Churchill.
Did you? What were your impressions when you met Churchill?
Well, I'd met him before because I knew his daughter Mary quite well, and so I had met him a couple of times beforehand.
Obviously, with your job at Chafe as well, what was Eisenhower like as a man?
Oh, delightful person. He really was. He was the man for the job. He was a born diplomat. And but one story about signing of the armistice, I should relate. I happened to be in Kay Summerby's office, his PA driver, when Donitz and the two senior German officers came to his office and came and gave the Hitler salute. So Eisenhower turned around to Beadle Smith, who was his number two, said, "Beadle, tell those officers to bugger off, come back in and give a proper military salute." So he went outside and did that. So that was one little instance. Then one other, just to show the quick and diplomatic side of Eisenhower, the prisoners of war were being picked up by the RAF and others to be brought home. And as they arrived at Reims airfield to refuel, they were being met by a bunch of fairly clueless senior army officers, colonels and majors, who treated these prisoners of war as though they were still on parade. And these buggers did not like it. And Eisenhower was told about this. And he said, "Christ, what am I going to..." we'd better get some of these RAF people up there quickly to take over from these from the army. And we would, about 12 of us were told to go up there and to placate these prisoners of war who were really feeling bloody brassed off. And so we went up to all the aeroplanes, talked to them all, made them happy, gave them cigarettes, and made certain they had a cup of tea, etc., etc. And they were more than happy. But that was just an indication of how clued up Eisenhower himself was.
It also seems it's quite a change in ethos from what we talked about right at the start of the war, from the senior officers you were used to the way that you were dealing with
people
at that point.
Oh, yes. The ethos was different, period.
I also believe at that time you were involved in the organisation of the flypast of quite a number of aircraft for Zhukov's visit to Eisenhower.
Oh, yes. After a briefing one morning, Spatz, I think it was, Chairman said, Ike wants us to lay on a flypast of 2,500 aeroplanes from all our air forces for Zhukovs who are coming in tomorrow morning. No. In 24 hours' time. I said, Christ. Okay, fine. So I went down to the office and got hold of all the others. Said, this is what's happening. So all we did was we rang up each air force, said, X number of airplanes, please, at such and such a time. You will be given an operational order of your exact timing for the staff visit of Marshal Zhukov to Eisenhower. Can do? So, yeah, can do. And so did all the necessary paperwork, all literally in a matter of 5 or 6 hours, organized the whole thing. And next morning at 10 o'clock, Zhukov arrives. Vroom, vroom, vroom. And
was it? Could you work out what his impression of all that airport was?
Oh yes, he was very, very impressed, and in good formations too. It wasn't, and it was the timing more than anything else that we were proud of.
Yeah. Strikes me as quite a diplomatic move by Eisenhower.
Oh, of course it was. Yeah, but. That was what you could do with communications. You could get X number of air forces to operate, to plan a flight past, which is 2,500 airplanes, a lot of airplanes.
Were you involved in any victory flight pasts at the end of the war?
Yes, one, which is quite an interesting one. Dowding, yes. Dowding was asked to have the victory parade over London led by 12 of the leaders, including Douglas, who had just been released from prison of war camp. And so I was a part of this with my black Spitfire and my 4 stars, and I was a part of it. And we had 12 of the well-known wing leaders and famous air racers all flying, and the photographs taken by the press of the whole formation being led by these 12 airplanes in reasonable formation. In reasonable formation. Yeah.
Now, after a number of appointments, I believe you then started to fly jets in about 1949, didn't you?
Whenever, yes. That's right. When I was still... What was I doing? I'm trying to remember what I was doing.
Because I think you'd been to the Staff College, hadn't you?
I'd been to Staff College.
And you'd been to Malaya flying Spitfires.
Oh, that's right. Of course, I'd forgotten all about that. My next appointment from SHAPE headquarters was to go to the occupational forces in Japan. And I was PA to chap called Boy Boucher, who then became the senior airman to MacArthur in Korea. Anyway, that was a boring bloody old job, that one was.
What was Japan like under occupation?
Very boring, because there's no fraternisation, and it's all very sad. And I had a good look at Hiroshima. That was a frightening bloody sight, to see the town flattened as it was.
I imagine that must have been quite a sobering thought, obviously, because you've been involved with air power for the last 10 years.
That's right, and being an airman, and then to see... But we'd been properly briefed in our careers that these bombs were necessary to save thousands of lives on both sides.
And was this place still flattened?
Oh, completely and utterly, yeah. And you could still see, the signs of bodies up against the bridges and things like that. Very sobering thought.
After Japan, I think you went to Malaya?
I had to go to Malaya because I'd had enough of Japan. And I was given an appointment, a staff appointment, and then was invited to stay on the Air Force with a permanent commission. Nothing really to relate, except I played quite a lot of rugby there and enjoyed myself.
And when you came back to the UK, I think that was when you got your first introduction to jet aircraft.
Yes, I was posted back to England, back to West Raynham, which was the airfield that had the unit that I had commanded during the war, called the Fighter Leader School. And so once again, I had the job of teaching squadron commanders and station commanders, and occasionally no wing leaders, on the use of rockets and bombs on the very latest Spitfire then, which was the Spit 14, I think it was. By this time, I had converted at Colern onto the jet aeroplanes, the Meteor, once again. There's the petrol, and so I was an expert on Meteors. And then we were re-equipped with the Vampire instead of the Spitfires, and I learned how to... operate jet aeroplanes with rockets and bombs.
The jet, was it a big transition at all from a...
No. The only real difference was the reaction time of the engine. The jet engine was much slower than positive reaction with a piston. And therefore, if one had to be a little more... experienced that if you were getting a bit too slow or a bit too fast, that you adjusted the engine power accordingly.
And what was the Meteor like?
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. Two engines, a very simple aeroplane to fly, and from there, I didn't fly the Meteor at West Raynham. I flew that when I was given yet another wing at Linton on the Ouse, outside York, when I had three Meteor squadrons, and the only thing that Linton was famous for was the mass takeoff of 24 Meteors, all in one go, and the landing also, because at the time the threat to the Great Britain from Russia was many versus many, and therefore we were expecting them to send out masses of jet aeroplanes, and to that we, with the masses of jet interceptor fighters, would take these large formations on. So we had to, for about 2 years, we had to perfect a system of getting 24 aeroplanes off in a hurry, into the air in a hurry, into position in a hurry. And that was one of our main task. And but I put on particular displays here, there, and everywhere of 24 meteors all taking off at the same time. It looked very hairy, but in most of these, I didn't do anything I didn't ask anybody to do anything that I hadn't done. So I flew in every position that was dangerous in these mass takeoffs. Because if you can imagine 24 jet aeroplanes and jet engines, and not 24, that was 24 multiplied by 2. There was a lot of turbulence involved. But we didn't have any accidents.
Had the interceptor tactics changed, though, from the period when you were...
No, it was basically still the first. It's still the same primary. As much early warning as possible. And we had very sophisticated early warning systems there, including Germany, including this, that and the other. So, and as many aeroplanes that could be managed as possible per target.
I believe at that time there were quite a few meteor crashes.
Yes, there were, and never truly explained. A lot of them through mismanagement of the oxygen system. But otherwise, with all the inquiries we had after each accident, nobody could pinpoint what the real reason was. There was no common reason apart from oxygen. But then from meteors we went over to sabers, and from sabers to the hunters, etc., etc.
I think the Meteor Mark 8, was that the one that was used by the Australians operationally in Korea?
The Mark 8 is what we had, and the Australians. Yeah. But Korea was in the end, they stopped sending us out because they were sending wing leaders, wing commanders out to Korea, and the attrition rate was too high because the Chinese army, as such, if they saw an airplane, just put their rifles up and fire. So the amount of, again, ACAC, in this case, rifle bullets, was high, and we were losing an unnecessary number of very, very experienced RAF operational pilots.
Were you getting any reports back from the Australians about how the aircraft was working in a kind of operational war zone type of thing?
Possibly, but I wasn't involved in that, no.
I believe you're also with HQ 2nd Tactical Air Force at one stage.
Yes, I was chief of 2nd. I was deputy chief of RAF intelligence in 2nd Tactical Air Force, which is quite interesting in that we were the front line. This is still with the Russians as our main enemy. And we had a tie-in with American intelligence, and also, very interesting, with ex-German intelligence in the form of civilians that had been started up by, forgotten his name now, the chief of the Abwehr.
Canaris.
Canaris, exactly, the admiral. And so I met one or two Very interesting German ex-service people, including one who had flown something like 750 missions from Norway and elsewhere in Heinkel's 111s. Anyway, we were talking one day, he said, do you know I've never flown in a jet? Can you? Oh, nice, sure. Come down any time. I'll fix it up. So I fixed it up. And I said to him, what would you like to do? He said, everything. I want the works. I said, what, aerobatics? Yes, everything. So I said, right, you bastard. And really gave him the works. He was as sick as a dog when we landed. I said, Colonel, we have a tradition in the Royal Air Force. He said, don't say it, because we have exactly the same in the German Air Force. I will clean the airplane up. And that was that.
Actually, can I ask you about that? Obviously, operating in jets. What are the forces on a pilot that might not be the same case with piston engines? Because people tend to be much more violently sick in jets.
I don't remember meeting any pilot who's sick, except you could be if you were in a transport aeroplane in very, very bumpy weather. Because the way you overcome seasickness or airsickness is if you've got a horizon. And in an aeroplane, of course, you've got the horizon, you fly by the horizon, or you've got the bloody instruments and you haven't got time to be sick.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in this intelligence that you were gathering. What was the type of information you specifically were looking for?
My job there was to look at the location and types of aeroplanes in Eastern Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and everywhere, and the follow-up of units in Russia that would be targeted against Germany. That was our mission, because it was the German sphere of influence that we were interested, not European. But that was Schaeff's job. And the interesting side of that was that in the various shape scenarios, the French kept on saying, look, you can say whatever you like, but if we are going to be bombed, if Paris is going to be bombed, whatever you bloody well say, we're not going to take any notice of Berlin or Rotterdam. We are going to defend. And that was the reason that virtually the whole air situation in the shape sphere of influence came to a shuddering halt, that you couldn't trust the French to work as a team.
Were you getting good quality information on the Russian jets?
Oh, yes, all of it. But that was from Emmons resources, not ourselves. But what we did find of great interest was that we were paying our spies as such for a job that they were doing against East Germany in Berlin, da da da. And when we were correlating our information with the information that the Americans were operating on, which they were getting from these boys, was that we were both using the same source of espionage. So we said bollocks to that. We're not going to pay any more money.
Did you perceive, obviously, at this stage that the Russians would have been an actual threat rather than just the Cold War position that you were in?
I was never in absolute I was not an absolute authority on the actual threat, because it was on need to know, and even although I was a deputy chief of RAF intelligence, my information was restricted. I think the commanders-in-chief and others had more up-to-date information from SHAFE headquarters than we did.
But you would have monitored movements, would you?
Oh, yes. Their capabilities, we weren't. I was not in a position to evaluate.
So when you finished with the Tactical Air Force, where did you go next?
Oh, yes. Then I went back and was given a refresher flying course at Manby, sent to the Eastern Sector as a controller on the air defence system in England.
I think your next posting was attaché to Bern, wasn't it?
And then posted to Bern as the air attaché. And the reason, basically, that I was posted there was I'd been at school in Switzerland. I did most of my skiing in Switzerland, and I taught the two languages. That was a very, very interesting. I had just got married as well, so one son was born in England, and the other one was born in England too. So my two sons were born at that period.
What's the role of an air attaché? What does an air attaché do?
Well, it's a very interesting question. That in normal countries, I could answer that just like that. But when you're talking about the two neutral countries in Europe, Switzerland and Sweden, then it's a totally different story, because you're not permitted as an outsider to spy on those two countries. Whereas as an air attaché, you covertly spy on their activities as much as overtly. And the first briefing you are given by the Swiss authorities, say, you realise that we are neutral. And by that, it's explained that the two countries that are absolutely neutral are Sweden and Switzerland, but according to a treaty signed last century, and that being neutral, they have to be able to defend themselves first, and then if they are attacked and able to defend themselves, every other country that signed this treaty must come to the aid of these two neutral countries. So, one's first briefing by the Swiss authorities was that please enjoy this place. We know that you enjoy skiing. We know you enjoy da 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 da. But if you are caught doing any naughties in our country, we will have to ask you to leave the same way as we would have to ask the Russians or the Chinese to leave. We are neutral. If you want to ask any question or you want to know anything, ask us and maybe we will give you the answers. So the whole 3 years I was there, I asked four times and got three no's. But I ended up, funny enough, as the doyen. The doyen is the chief, as against either the Russians who wanted the job or the Chinese who wanted the job. And an old Inglesey gets the job.
D- Did you do any covert intelligence gathering?
Once. Not covert, so it was rather stupid. I looked at...